Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case this morning is Fredrickson versus Madigan. And I guess we're starting with Mr. Gillian.
Good morning, Judge Kaney, honorable judges of the court. If it pleases the court, Patrick Gillian for the Thomas More Society on behalf of the appellants Umholtz and Dieters. I'm cognizant of the fact that the court has only given me 10 minutes of time, so I intend to briefly sketch our position, why we're in front of the court today, and ask for questions. The short story as to our presence before the court today began on February 28, 2008, when Judge Kaur entered an order refusing to provide relief from the injunction which restrained state officials, including my clients, Umholtz and Dieters, from enforcing Illinois' Parental Notice Act. At that time, after reviewing the order, my clients determined that Judge Kaur had made patent errors of law. He had both misinterpreted the Illinois' Parental Notice Act at Section 25G and, in addition, had ignored the effect of Illinois' Minors Consent to Medical Procedures Act. As non-named class members, our clients did what was appropriate under the circumstances and sought to confer with the named class representatives for the purpose of zealously advancing their position that the Illinois Parental Notice Act was constitutional and relief from the injunction restraining enforcing and application implementation of that act was appropriate. They sought to confer with their class representative for the state's attorneys. They were told that the state's attorney's class representative would defer to the attorney general. They sought to confer with the attorney general's office for the purpose of having the attorney general take the procedural step that is provided by the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure in order to remedy a patent error of law, that is, to file a motion under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure, Rule 59. Over the short 10-day period in which they had that option available to them, their calls to the Attorney General's office were not returned. Therefore, believing that their interests were not adequately represented, they did the only thing they could do under circuit precedent at that time. They filed a Rule 59 motion, believing they had standing under Devlin v. Scardetti, and in an abundance of caution, pursuant to this circuit's decision in Roe, they also filed a motion to intervene. Unfortunately, on March, that was a timely filed motion on March 13, 2008. Unfortunately, on March 20th, 2008, Judge Kaur, the sitting judge below, held a brief hearing on the motion that had been filed by my clients to secure relief from a patent error of law in the order of February 28, 2008, and made an erroneous determination that he did not have jurisdiction to rule on that Rule 59 motion. That brings us before this court, and we seek relief. In short, what we'd ask the court to do is grant the remand with directions to grant that Rule 59 motion, because the fact of the matter is, so far as we can make out, although the law is unclear, the appropriate way to look at the current procedural posture of this court is to find that under either Devlin v. Scardetti or this court's decision in Roe v. City of Highland Falls, our clients were capable of filing a Rule 59 motion. That Rule 59 motion, like the notice of appeal in Roe, enjoys the full effect of a motion under the rule. Therefore, it should toll the time for taking the appeal, and our motion should be granted. I understand that the other parties have taken the position that we were not allowed to intervene and that our Rule 59 motion was not entitled to the effect it's ordinarily given. But I respectfully submit that those arguments are in error. For one thing, we are entitled to proceed, as we tried to maintain in the court below, under Devlin v. Scardetti as non-party class members who objected to the decision below.
Mr. Gillian, I'm having difficulty understanding why we can't just address the issues that you wanted to raise below on the direct appeal, why those aren't before us on the direct appeal. Why would we need to send it back for your intervention?
Well, this is we're in a procedural quandary. The question, that question hinges on whether or not, what effect the Rule 59 motion below is given. In this case, what you have is a Rule 59 motion, which tolls the effectiveness of the other notices of appeal. If this court determines it has that effect, as we believe it does under the circuit precedent.
What's in your 59 motion that can't be argued by the appellants here?
There is nothing. There is nothing on the merits. But before it all, this court is famous for the rigor with which it approaches the jurisdictional inquiry. That's why we're here. It's that concern at this point that brings me in front of you to say, look, one of two things are going to happen here. This court's going to determine, based on the decision below, that there was a proper transfer of jurisdiction from the district court to the Court of Appeals. If it does that, it can rule on the merits based on the appeal. If it determines that the district court made a mistake when it failed to give the effect to our Rule 59 motion that's required by FRAP 4, Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 4, then this court has essentially jurisdiction in this matter based on an erroneous jurisdictional determination below. In that case, it seems under circuit precedent, the way the court overall approaches that quandary would be, we think, the most efficient way to remand with directions to grant the Rule 59. That's the quandary that brings me in front of the court. If the court determines it has jurisdiction to reach the merits, then there's no question it can grant the relief we requested in the Rule 59. But before it does this, this court, their cases are legion. I teach a course in appellate practice. Seventh Circuit opinions dominate the book. The court always conducts its own jurisdictional inquiry. If it determines that it doesn't have jurisdiction based on the effect of the Rule 59 that was filed below, or the transfer was inappropriate, it seems to me that consistent with the overarching disposition of such cases by this court, it could send it back with directions to grant the Rule 59 motion. In that way, addressing both the jurisdictional problem, correcting the erroneous jurisdictional determination below, and also directing, based on the jurisdiction it has now, that the Rule 59 be granted. That's another route to the outcome that you describe. And I freely confess, it's truly no party before this court today has cited a case that is right on point. We are all, I and representing my clients, we're all trying to make sense of a very complicated issue, the transfer of jurisdiction, and cases that are close but not right on. Here, the principal issues that confront the court there are, what is the scope of the rule allowing non-party appeal in Devlin v. Scardetti? And also, what is the effect of Roe v. City of Highland Falls? Is there any reason why this court, having held that the notice of appeal filed by a non-party would-be intervener in Roe had the effect of a notice of appeal and did transfer jurisdiction to the Court of Appeals, would then turn around and say that the analogous motion to be filed in the trial court, a motion under Rule 59, doesn't have effect when filed, as here, by a would-be intervener? That's the difficult question that confronts the court, and that brings me in front of you today. We think that we should be allowed to proceed, if you decide we can proceed under Devlin, as non-party class members who have objected to the disposition below and have standing to appeal based on Devlin, then the court can reach the merits based on the representations which we have made and the Solicitor General. If not, then the court has to look at what's the implications of Roe versus City of Highland Falls for this case. How should that be treated? In that case, this court would arguably have jurisdiction based on the erroneous jurisdictional determination below, and I think it could remand, make that determination, and yet remand with directions to grant the Rule 59.
And what would that achieve if we did what?
If you did that, Judge Kenney, that would achieve what we sought within 10 days of the error below. It would correct the error. It would also, I think, serve the interest of judicial economy, efficiency, and fairness to the parties, because we would get the proper result if the result was as we requested in the Rule 59, without wasting further time in this court. I see my yellow light is on. I think I'll step down and save my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Feldman. Mr. Scudrow.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. I'm Michael Scudrow from the Office of the Illinois Attorney General, here on behalf of the defendants' appellants in case number 1620 and appellants' defendants' cross-appellees, in case number 1782. I'd like to just begin, if I might, to respond to two points raised just now in the opening comments. The first had to do with the suggestion, although this is, of course, extra record, but the suggestion that the Attorney General's office was in some way unwilling to respond to concerns raised or calls made by absent class members. And I would just emphasize, again, though none of this is in the record, that it's my understanding that the Attorney General's office did respond to and confer with any absent class member who did contact the office. It may be, and this may be the reference that was made, that the Thomas More Society, not as a class member, but as an entity, had tried to contact the office and did not speak to anyone or receive a call back prior to the notice of appeal. But anyone who called on behalf of an absent class member who purported to be, it's my understanding that they were they spoke to someone in the office.
Class members are state's attorneys.
That's correct, Your Honor. The state's attorney now, Alvarez, is the representative of a defendant class constituting all 102 Illinois state's attorneys. That's correct. The other point I would simply make is I agree with the comment made by Judges Caney and Tinder that there's very little to be gained by, at this point, remanding this for further proceedings below. And I would further add that as a jurisdictional question, as we point out in our brief as appellee, the Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 4A4B1 covers the circumstance and indicates that even if a timely Rule 59E had been filed, and here it was not because they were not yet granted leave to file anything as a party to the case, but even had they filed a timely Rule 59E motion on the 13th of March, the District Court disposed of that motion on the 20th of March, and by operation of FRAP 4A4B1, at that point, the Attorney General's, the defendant's notice of appeal would become active, and therefore, as a matter of jurisdiction, there's no issue before the court. Unless the court at this point has further questions regarding the intervention question raised in appeal number 1782, I would like to begin with the merits raised in appeal number 1620. At this point in the proceeding, the facial challenge to Illinois' Parental Notice of Abortion Act has reduced to a single issue, and that issue involves the judicial bypass provision set forth in the Act. In addition to four other exceptions to the notice requirement, all of which are set out in Section 20 of the Act, Section 25 permits a minor to bypass the notice requirement by making either of two showings. First, that she is mature and informed enough within the meaning of the statute to make the decision to have the procedure without notice. And second, that abortion without notice would be in her best interests. Either or, if she persuades the circuit court by preponderance of the evidence that either of these things are true, she is entitled to a bypass under the statute. Now, the district court here sustained the permanent injunction solely on the ground out of concern that minors who qualify under the second ground, D2, so-called best interest minors, would have no way to consent to the abortion itself. And as we point out in our brief, there are two independent reasons why this is not a concern and why the district court's decision is therefore in error. The first is that Section 25 itself authorizes the minor to consent to the procedure. And the second, were that not the case, the background statute of the Consent by Minors Act under Illinois law gives pregnant minors the full rights of adults to make any and all decisions about their own medical care, including abortions. Now, the plaintiffs have advanced a distinct theory, and they advanced it before the district court as well. It's one that the court neither expressly endorsed nor rejected below, and that is that circuit courts in Illinois under Section 25 must decide first whether a minor satisfies Section 25D1, the mature and informed prong, before that court is permitted to consider whether the minor satisfies Section 25D2, the so-called best interest prong. Accordingly, plaintiffs argue, in all cases, or I should say furthermore, plaintiffs argue, in all cases in which a circuit court is going to find a 25D2 basis for the waiver, the court will have already rejected any 25D1 argument, and furthermore will have included superfluous findings in the court's order indicating that this minor is neither mature nor informed. And that minor then essentially will have been given something by one hand that will be taken by the other.
Wouldn't that be implicit in reaching that D2 test? That wouldn't that imply that the judge had already found the person immature or uninformed?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. There are many provisions in Illinois law, in federal law. We cite Strickland. We cite an Illinois statute involving juveniles where you have multi-factor tests. There's no requirement to reach them in a particular order. We cited Strickland as an example. And so often federal courts begin and end their analysis with prejudice under Strickland because it's the easier one. When you have a disjunctive test, as Strickland is, if you fail under either, you fail. Here, if you succeed under either, you succeed. And therefore, it makes perfect sense. This we have to recall this minor will have both an attorney, if she wishes, paid for by the state, and a guardian ad litem with her. And it makes perfect sense that these individuals will advance whatever they deem to be her stronger argument.
Do those carry over the guardian ad litem to the consent process as well?
It's my understanding, Your Honor, and of course all of this, the law has never gone into effect, and so I have nothing to fall back on in terms of how it's been implemented in practice. Traditionally, it's my understanding that guardians ad litem, the role is limited to the courtroom. I shouldn't say the courtroom, but to the litigation process as opposed to the consent process. If I may continue, the first answer, another answer to Your Honor's question.
Well, following up on Judge Tinder's question, if the guardian ad litem would have authority to involve himself or herself in a consent process, would that make a difference?
Well, I think clearly, Your Honor, if the guardian ad litem were permitted to give consent for the minor, and again, for several reasons in our brief, we don't think that's at all necessary. But if the guardian ad litem were entitled to do that, then I think it would eliminate any and all concerns here about the potential effect of dicta under D1 somehow eviscerating the minor's statutory authority under the Consent by Minors Act to consent to her own medical care. So one of the issues here, of course, is that contrary to best practices as outlined by the U.S. Supreme Court, the Illinois Supreme Court, in cases we cite in our brief, what's being suggested here is that as a matter of practice, if not mandate, Illinois circuit courts are going to make a practice of including extraneous findings in their order. And indeed, one further point in response to Your Honor's question about implied findings, the brief of the plaintiffs makes clear they're talking about concern about express findings. That term is used. And so we're talking about a potential express finding that would be dicta in light of the D2 authority that the court finds.
If a person, a minor, gets hit with that gratuitous findings,
yes,
of immature and uninformed or uninformed, but then it's found that the abortion is in her best interest.
Yes, Your Honor.
Would you agree that that person has no right of appeal under the statute or any other provision of Illinois law?
I would agree, Your Honor, that the individual does not have a right of appeal. I would say, however, that with her attorney there, that attorney should make every effort to procure an order that is pure in the sense that it simply grants her the relief she requests, or to some sort of reconsideration, or would be an order at that point by her court-appointed attorney.
But the difficulty for that minor is that they then proceed to the consent process with the label of immature or uninformed, and can they give consent
right
in that situation?
I think I have three potential answers or responses to the issue Your Honor raises. The first is that Section 25 itself, by virtue of Section 25F, indicates that the General Assembly understood itself to be granting, with the bypass, to be granting the minor the authority to consent to the procedure. And therefore, notwithstanding any dicta under Section D1, the 25 order itself has the legal effect of authorizing her to consent.
But it is not a consent itself. It's not an order that the abortion be performed.
It's not. Section 30 of the Act, Your Honor, makes clear, out of an abundance of caution, that the minor still must consent to the procedure to eliminate any potential, I assume, to eliminate any potential misunderstanding that because a court has found a procedure to be in her best interest, that it somehow has to occur. Obviously, she still needs to consent to the procedure. But what she has been done is authorized to consent to that procedure. She has all lawful authority to do so. I would add, Your Honor, a final point on this score, and that is that there has been no showing of a legal identity between maturity, as that term is used in Section 25D1, and the bare capacity requirements that Illinois law requires for any individual to consent to any medical procedure. And recall that we're speaking here of adult capacity because these minors are being treated as adults by virtue of the Consent by Minors Act. So the lack of capacity that would prohibit a minor from consenting would have to be the same kind of lack of capacity that would derail any adult from consenting to medical treatment.
That's not the same as immaturity, is it?
It's not, Your Honor. The two are distinct. And therefore, even if all of the combination of occurrences that are presaged in the briefing here were to occur, the plaintiffs foretell, there would still be it would simply be of no effect with regard to her capacity to consent as a matter of Illinois law. Indeed, if one looks at the cases cited in pages 14 and 15 of the defendant's reply brief before this court, there's a stark divide between the sorts of factors, to be sure, some overlap, but a very different focus in the factors between the bare capacity required to make a medical decision and the sorts of more, and indeed in many ways more profound issues that courts sometimes consider in deciding whether one is mature in the D1 sense. And I would simply add, too, that Bilotti itself, the 1979 decision that created the two bypass factors that are now embodied in Section 25D, that case itself in footnote 23 acknowledged that there may well be a difference between the sort of background capacity that a state's law requires, a matter of statute or common law, and the constitutional maturity standard that the Bilotti court itself was requiring as a matter of bypass, the sort of maturity that's required not merely to consent to a procedure, but to have an entitlement to a constitutional right to that procedure.
This question of consent doesn't require any sort of level of information, does it? Provision about being informed would have no bearing on consent, would it?
Under Illinois common law, Your Honor, the informed consent...
Under the statutory provision for minor consent...
The Consent by Minors Act, Your Honor. With the Consent by Minors Act, you're right. It simply, if I'm understanding Your Honor's question, it takes away age as what would otherwise be a prima facie evidence of the minor's lack of maturity under Illinois law.
Right. An uninformed minor can consent under that provision, right?
Cannot, you said, Your Honor?
Can consent.
An uninformed minor, well, I think, Your Honor, they would have to, I believe they would have to have the same kind of information that any adult would have to have. But that's simply a matter of, as both briefs point out, doctors are, you know, they
right.
As a matter of practice.
General medical practices.
Exactly. Indeed, several of the cases that we cite are cases specifically in which many of the ones one will find in researching the informed consent issue in Illinois involve instances in which there were medical battery claims raised precisely because the physician, not because the individual was so lacking in capacity that he or she couldn't understand information, but rather that the physician failed to disclose relevant information or simply misled the individual in terms of factual information about it. So that is still, of course, required to the individual must understand the basics of the procedure and so on. So. As this court has made clear and as the U.S. Supreme Court has made clear repeatedly and this court most recently in Newman in 2002 and Carlin versus Faust in 1999, the hurdle for a pre-enforcement facial challenge is a very, very high one. And as the court put it in Newman, a facial challenge cannot be successful if it rests entirely where the effects of the law are still open to debate. And at the very least here, even at the threshold of whether or not there is some likelihood that in a large fraction of cases, Illinois circuit courts are will make a practice of including this dicta, even there it is at best subject to debate. And, of course, beyond that, we have the fact that there's no equivalency between maturity and capacity. Beyond that, we have the fact that Illinois law under Section 25 itself indicates that the General Assembly understood itself to be authorizing minors when they were awarded a bypass provision. So in sum, plaintiff's position is not only impossible to square with these longstanding principles governing pre-enforcement facial challenges, but to prevail, plaintiffs have to be correct on all three distinct questions of Illinois law, and they're incorrect as to all three. First, they have to be able to show that an order under a Section 25D bypass order does not have the effect of authorizing the minor to consent. Second, they would have to be able to show that state courts are directed and will make a practice of finding D1 failures before entering awards under D2. And third and finally, they would have to show that there is a legal identity between maturity, as that term is used in D1, and capacity, as the term is used in Illinois common law. With respect, Your Honor, they cannot show any of these three things. And therefore, we ask the court to reverse the judgment below, or in the alternative, if this panel were to conclude that one or more of these state law questions is the dispositive question for purposes of this facial constitutional challenge, we would urge the court to certify that question or those questions to the Illinois Supreme Court pursuant to Circuit Rule 52A. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Cheat.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Lori Chaitin on behalf of the plaintiffs, appellees. Your Honor, under this law, there will be minors adjudicated to be too immature to intelligently decide whether to have an abortion, but for whom the bypass court will nevertheless rule that it is in their best interest not to involve their parents in their decision. And for such minors, the adjudication of immaturity in connection with the abortion decision vitiates their ability to consent in the informed consent process that the physician will undertake. These minors cannot appeal this determination because they will have been granted a waiver of notice on best interest grounds. And as the court has pointed out, the statute expressly precludes an appeal from a successful waiver petition. They are therefore left with only two options. The first is to forego their abortion that the Supreme Court has said that they are entitled to, and the second is to seek to obtain the consent of the very parents the bypass court just determined it was not in their best interest to include. This situation is without doubt constitutionally offensive under Bilotti and its progeny.
Aren't you equating consent with notice in making that statement?
Your Honor, we're not doing that because it's not that the Parental Notice Act imposes consent on its face. It's that as read in conjunction with the Minors Consent Act and the physician's obligation to obtain informed consent from one with capacity, it imposes a consent requirement on one adjudicated to be unable to make the very decision that the physician is seeking informed consent for. And so it's the effect, it's the legal effect of the adjudication that the minor is unable to intelligently decide whether to have an abortion. That's the language of the statute, that they are too immature and uninformed to intelligently decide whether to have an abortion. So a physician who receives a copy of this order and says, you know, is examining whether they can engage in an informed consent process and determine for themselves capacity will say, I can't because this young woman already has been adjudicated to be too immature and unable to make this decision.
Is that how this was argued below, that you have some evidence in the record of physicians indicating that they would not recognize consent from a person who is determined to be immature under the notice provision?
Your Honor, there are two points. One is that this particular defect in the statute was raised in our complaint in 1995 and attached to our motion for a preliminary injunction in 1995. There are affidavits of physicians who testified that they would, in fact, be chilled. But below on these proceedings, on the Rule 60 motion, the court concluded as a matter of law, by looking at the legal effect of the Parental Notice Act and how it relates to the informed consent process. Because once a minor, once the bypass court says, we don't think she can make this decision, regardless of whether there might be external factors that a bypass court might look at for maturity, once the bypass court says, we don't think this young woman can make this decision, no physician is going to accept her informed consent because there appears to be a court determination that she lacks the capacity that one has to have in order to give informed consent.
Well, what about the consent by minor statute?
Well, the consent by, as the Solicitor General pointed out, the consent by minor statute does not give all minors or all pregnant minors even the ability to consent. What it says is that by virtue of their minority, their consent is not void. It says that they are given
the same legal capacity to act and same powers as a person of legal age.
That is correct, Your Honor. And if a person of legal age had been adjudicated to lack the ability to make the very medical decision that they then go to the physician to try to consent to, and that physician has a copy of that order, that physician is not going to accept their consent. There, as this Solicitor General pointed out, there are medical battery cases, and we know from other states there are medical battery cases where doctors have been sued by parents who later find out about their daughter's abortion, and they sue for medical battery because they claim she was too young and that doctor was supposed to come to them for consent, even where there's no parental consent requirement in the state. So the reality is that a person who's an adult who lacks capacity will also be denied the ability to consent to medical care. Now, for adults, we have a whole separate process that we go through to, a number of statutes that address substitute decision-making. For minors, maturity is, for these purposes, really equated with capacity because we don't look at maturity for adults. We assume somebody who's over 18 is mature. But for somebody
not
who's...
Not a very good assumption.
Maybe not, Your Honor, but as the Bilotti, actually as the very footnote that the Solicitor General pointed to, as the Bilotti case recognized, states have to make some arbitrary, sometimes arbitrary, determinations about how we're going to treat people. But when you're dealing with abortion, you then have to get into a case-by-case analysis. And that's why, one of the reasons why the Bilotti court held that you had to have this alternative. One of the reasons is because a mature minor has a constitutional right to have an abortion without involving their parents. There is no...
Bilotti was a consent case, was it? Not a notice case.
Your Honor, that's correct. It was a consent case.
The Supreme Court has never held that notice is an undue burden on abortion, has it?
Your Honor, this court has. In Pearson, in Indiana, Planned Parenthood versus Pearson, this court held that the
Supreme
same...
Court.
Now, the Supreme Court has never held that one-parent notice is an undue burden on abortion. But this court, in analyzing the Supreme Court precedent, has held that in a one-parent notice requirement in Indiana, Planned Parenthood versus Pearson, the court said, for all of the same reasons, we believe that notice will impose the same burdens, will have the potential to have the same impact on the minor, that the parents might, in fact, prevent that young woman from being able to either get to court or get to the abortion provider. And as a result, we are going to say that the Bilotti factors, that the Bilotti inquiry is what is required for one-parent parental notice statutes.
What's the role of the guardian ad litem in this situation?
Your Honor, the guardian ad litem is if you look at the statute, the guardian ad litem's role is limited to representing the minor's best interest before the bypass court. There's nothing in the statute that suggests that the guardian ad litem's role has any effect outside of the litigation. And under Illinois law, typically, now this isn't something that obviously the state raised in their briefs, and we haven't briefed it, and we could, but typically under Illinois law, A guardian ad litem is appointed only in the context of litigation, and unless there's some statutory authority to give them the ability to operate outside. So, for example, sometimes in the adoption context that comes up. But unless there's a statutory authorization for them to operate outside the context of the litigation, that's where their role is limited. There's nothing in the statute that authorizes the guardian ad litem or the bypass court or, frankly, anyone else to provide consent for this abortion once that minor is adjudicated to be too immature and therefore unable.
Isn't that part and parcel of the litigation that's before the bypass court?
There's nothing in the statute that makes it part and parcel, Your Honor. The statute says in Section 25D, notice shall be waived if the bypass court concludes that the minor is mature enough to make her own decision, or if it is concluded that notice would not be in her best interest, that is when the bypass court waives notice. So, yeah, there's nothing that's part and parcel about giving consent. That's the problem here. You know, if we look at some of the other states' statutes, where there's going to be this kind of gap, the statutes actually include an authorization for consent. So, for example, in Lambert, that the state relies on, the Montana statute included an express authorization provision that once, it was also a notice statute, that once the minor was found to have notice waived, then the court would authorize the abortion to go forward. And, you know, so the Lambert court, contrary to what the defendants argue, doesn't really answer the question here because the issue that's before this court never even came up. The only issue in Lambert was what was the appropriate procedure before the court. Your Honor, I want to talk a little bit about the issue about maturity versus capacity. As I've said, the adjudication of immaturity by the bypass court is an adjudication that the minor is really unable to intelligently make this very decision. And so for minors, as I mentioned, one way that Illinois law evaluates capacity is to look at maturity. And this is consistent with the Illinois Supreme Court's case In Re E.G., which is cited in the briefs, where the Illinois Supreme Court established the mature minor doctrine. And there, the court said, if a minor is immature, quote unquote, she is, quote, thus incompetent, paren, lacking capacity, close paren, close quote. And that is consistent with the legislative findings in the Illinois Parental Notice Act. If you look at Section 5, the court uses the two terms for minors interchangeably. So the court says that, quote, immature minors often lack the ability to make fully informed choices. Now, the state cites a number of cases from bypass courts in other states where these laws have gone into effect, and there have been decisions about whether the minor really was mature or not. And they cite those cases, and those cases also support this idea that a bypass court is in fact going to look at capacity. So, for example, if you look at they cite a number of Doe cases. So I'm going to refer to this one as the Kansas Doe case. In the Kansas Doe case, the court defined maturity, and they use the word, maturity is, quote, the intellectual capacity, ellipse, to understand the situation at hand and the consequences of the choices that can be made. And this is not limited to the Kansas Doe case. And frankly, the cases that the state cites from Illinois regarding the difference between capacity and maturity, first of all, they're all limited to to a completely different area, and which is...
Well, maturity is a question of fact, isn't it?
Capacity is
not a question of fact. It's a legal presumption.
But, Your Honor, what happens in the informed consent process will be that the physician will have to assess whether this person before them has capacity. Once a bypass court has said they are unable to make this decision intelligently, no physician is going to believe that that person has capacity. I want to just move on to, unless you want to follow up on that question, I'd like to move on to the question of whether the statute can be read to assume this authorization, because that's what the state is arguing here. And the reality is that it just can't. Section 25 is actually very clear. 25D is the operative provision. It says, notice shall be waived if either of the following things happen. Section 25F that the state relies on doesn't empower the court to do anything. All it does is it's actually the provision that says that there's a right to a confidential and expeditious appeal. And So what it does is it says you can appeal from a denial of a waiver, but where the court authorizes you to go forward with the abortion without notice, then you don't have a right to appeal. So all it is a reference back to Section 25D, which is, in fact, the operative provision that says notice shall be waived. The Solicitor General also made the argument that the court somehow wouldn't determine maturity first. And I want to say that I think that he misstated slightly our position. We do not argue that in every single case maturity will be decided first. What we've argued is that really in the vast majority of cases, because it would be the rare case where the lawyer representing the young woman wouldn't actually make both arguments. And the other thing is that there's really a constitutional significance to the court deciding maturity first. The paramount importance of maturity under Bilotti is clearly established. As a constitutional matter, the state has no legitimate interest in promoting parental involvement for a mature minor.
Isn't best interest the simplest choice for the circuit judge, to go right to that and not mess with trying to determine maturity and information and so forth?
Your Honor, to the contrary, actually, maturity is the simplest because maturity...
Well, how can that be, though? Because the person doesn't have to be just mature but also informed.
Right. And
that's,
so the,
that's
the
a
court,
pretty high standard.
And the court has to ask them, you know, has to be convinced that they have the adequate information, that they understand the consequences of the decision that they're making. Capacity, right? And so it is actually far easier for the court, well, none of this is going to be easy, but it is easier for the court to determine that somebody is mature, to assess the maturity determination, because it's based on the minor who's standing before the court. And again, so you've got it based on the minor who's standing before the court. The court can ask her questions, can determine whether she does have the information, and whether what they look at some things. Does she understand the consequences? Is she a responsible person? When you get into best interests, it's the standard that is far more intrusive into the family's interests. And keep in mind, Bilotti was a balance between, you know, respecting the family's interests versus the mature minor's constitutional right to access abortion and the right of a minor who should not involve her parents to access abortion. And so the best interest standard is a lot more murky, right? The court has to look at what is her relationship with her parents, what are the family dynamics, you know, situations where, you know, she'll make claims about, for example, my older sister was kicked out of the house, or I'm afraid my mother's going to have a nervous breakdown. I mean, whatever the family, interfamily relationships are, the minor is not the only one involved, whereas with maturity, there are some pretty well-established factors to look at, and you've got the minor standing right there.
What's the role of the guardian ad litem in this situation? We're almost, you know, like guardian ad litem is ignored. We're just dealing with her counsel and...
No, the guardian ad litem is there to help represent her best interests, and presumably a guardian ad litem will, as her counsel will, help her to advance the strongest arguments on both grounds because they're trying to help her seek a waiver. Your Honor, I do want to quickly mention that in the Strickland does not set a hard, fast rule for the order of determinations. The court looked at practical considerations, and the practical considerations that I'm talking about here actually would lead to maturity first. But I also want to address the large fraction issue. The defendants have argued that we're required to show that there's a constitutional violation in a large fraction of cases before we ever get to the question of whether there is a constitutional violation. And that's just not the way it works. But we don't even need to get to that here, because the Supreme Court in Ayotte in 2006 made clear that in a pre-enforcement challenge, the court can conclude that a statute has unconstitutional applications. And where it does that, the plaintiffs are entitled to relief against at least those applications. So the question is really one of proper remedy. We've got a situation where there will be minors who are adjudicated to be unable to make this decision on their own, and in whose best interests are not served by parental involvement. So once you have that, you know that minor cannot go and consent. And The preference, of course, so you have a constitutional violation. What the court in Ayotte said is the preference is for the narrowest possible injunction. So what the body of law, which we've argued in our brief on facial invalidation, is a separate kind of situation. In Ayotte, where they found that the lack of a medical emergency exception in the New Hampshire parental notice statute would have an unconstitutional burden on a small number of minors, the court then said, okay, we now know that this is going to burden a small number of people. Let's look at remedy. And what the court said is we want to try to enter the narrowest injunction possible to try to enjoin the unconstitutional applications. But whatever we do, it is not our job to rewrite the statute for the legislature. So we've got to make sure that what we're doing is consistent with legislative intent. Here, the legislative intent is absolutely clear. The Illinois General Assembly knew when it passed this law that having an adequate and effective bypass was critical to having this statute work properly. The Governor Edgar, when he signed the bill, had a signing statement where he made the same point. And they included in Section 50 of the statute a severability and inseverability provision. And the inseverability provision says that where there's a material defect in the bypass, the entire statute must fall. So consistent with legislative intent, the only remedy here for the constitutional applications is for the entire statute to fall. And this is actually consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Ayotte, where at the end of the decision on page 332, the court, in that case, what the court didn't know what the legislative intent was and sent it back to the lower courts to try to determine legislative intent. And the court said, you know, basically, there will either be an injunction that is limited to the unconstitutional applications, or there will be an injunction that invalidates the statute in toto, quote unquote. And so it clearly was a recognition that in a case like this, on a pre-enforcement challenge, where it is clear that there are unconstitutional applications, it is the obligation of the court to remedy those, to remedy against those, and to enter an injunction that at the very least protects against those unconstitutional violations.
Doesn't your construction of the Act ignore its purpose, which is to require notice to parents unless a court waives notification because of the two things that we've been talking about, maturity and best interest? But your interpretation would disallow all best interest abortions without notification, wouldn't it? Aren't you defeating the purpose of the legislation?
Your Honor, my red light is on, but if I may quickly answer and sum up. The answer to the question is that the purpose of the legislation is to encourage parental involvement with the understanding that there has to be an adequate alternative. This statute, as written, does not provide that adequate alternative. And so if we were to say, well, yeah, but, you know, it's inconsistent with the purpose, then every time that a legislature thinks it's passed a constitutional law and a constitutional defect has been presented, then the statute would have to be upheld, notwithstanding the fact that, as here, there is no question that there will be immature minors who are adjudicated to be too immature and unable to make their abortion decision, but in whose best interest it is not to involve their parents. There will be unconstitutional applications, and it is this court's obligation to remedy those applications consistent with the legislative intent. Thank you so much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Gillian, how much time? You have 1 minute.
Thank you very much, Your Honor, and I won't waste the court's time. I have 2 points, and then if there are no questions, I'll sit down. First, with respect to the difficulties that our clients encountered below, those are reflected in the motion to intervene and Rule 59 motion in the district court, so they're in the record. Second, if this court determines that it does have jurisdiction, then we would urge reversal on the grounds that are now being advanced by the Solicitor General for the Attorney General. If you have no questions, listen now. I thank the court for its time.
Thank you. Mr. Scudrill. How much time? 8 minutes.
Several points to make in response, Your Honor. First, I would just note the reference to Bilotti, and this was made in the briefs as well, that Bilotti makes maturity the paramount standard. Indeed, Bilotti talks about maturity first, and I understand the argument being made, but Section 25 is very clear to circuit courts. It's either or. Just as Strickland is quite clear, it's no more or less rigid than Strickland. The point is courts can rule. It's a disjunctive test on one or the other. And as in any such disjunctive test, courts are allowed to rule on any of them in any order, depending in part on how they're presented. During argument, the plaintiffs have essentially added yet another layer of speculation, quite at odds with this Court's decisions in Carlin and again in Newman. That is, that we're not supposed to tread where questions are at least open to debate. Here, not only is the speculation, there are two predictions about human behavior here. One, that although courts may not be required to deal with D1 first, they will do so and will include dicta in their order. And further, that the order that is received by the physician will include that dicta. That is, that the attorney has not seen fit to find a separate order, for example, given to the physician, but that the physician reads the opinion, and further, that that physician concludes that he or she cannot proceed with the procedure. And on top of these predictions are three predictions about Illinois law. And as we point out, all of them are false. Indeed, if this seems an eminent situation where if the court were going to conclude, in response to Judge Coffey's question, or Cudahy's question, if the court were going to conclude that the act on the one hand gives you something and at the other hand withdraws the very same thing, it would be appropriate to allow the Illinois Supreme Court to make that determination in the first instance. It not only seems profoundly at odds with the purpose that obviously undergirds the act, but at the same time, it's inconsistent with the sentence in Section 25F. Now, I understand the argument on the other side is that Section 25F, that sentence, is merely a reference back to 25D. It is. But what it shows is that the General Assembly saw that what they were doing in 25D was authorizing. They saw it as one and the same. By granting a waiver of notice, the General Assembly understood themselves to be granting leave to consent. Indeed, had they wanted somehow to withhold that right, they would have made very clear in the second sentence of 25F that what they were talking about was merely the waiver of notice, not the authorization of the abortion without notice. And that's how that sentence reads. I would also add there was some reference to the medical battery cases. The cases to which I referred were instances in which courts had found that, and this does occur with some regularity, the courts had found that patients, adult patients, were simply uninformed. They had not been informed properly about the nature or scope or side effects of the procedure they were about to undergo. That actually raises a point that indirectly goes back to a question that Judge Tinder had asked earlier, and that is, what about an implied finding under D1? Well, D1, recall, requires a minor to be both mature and informed, and therefore an implied finding or even an express finding that merely says D1 not satisfied here leaves open the possibility that the minor was simply uninformed at the time she appeared before the circuit court judge. Well, that's easily remedial in the same way that physicians always inform patients, or should always inform patients, about the nature of the procedure they're about to undergo. So even an implied finding that D1 isn't satisfied by no means indicates that she's immature. It may just as easily indicate that she simply wasn't properly informed about the procedure when she appeared before the court. There was a reference to the Ayotte case. I'd simply note that in Ayotte, we were talking about women who, it was well known, would have health problems, and they would not be covered by the exception, the medical exception that was in the act. Here, there is no showing. We're in the realm of pure subject of debate, to use the phrase used in this court's decision in Newman, as to whether or not courts will engage in a practice of including this dicta, which is completely unnecessary under the act, whether physicians will see that opinion, and whether those physicians will interpret it in a manner that prohibits them from proceeding. All of that is perfect grounds for a as-applied challenge. But as this court and the U.S. Supreme Court has made clear repeatedly, it is not the basis for a pre-enforcement facial challenge. There was a reference to the use of Lambert. Let me just be very clear about the way defendants have relied on the Supreme Court's decision in Lambert. We have not read Lambert to address the issue raised here squarely. What Lambert holds is that a statutory provision that says that notice is not in the minor's best interest is tantamount to a provision that says abortion without notice is not in the minor's best interest. The point of that, and this again, this goes back to Judge Cudahy's question and the purpose undergirding the statute, is that what they're suggesting is that the legislature has put in place a system whereby a court under D2 can conclude that abortion without notice, because that is tantamount to what the language that's used in D2 pursuant to Lambert, that abortion without notice is in this minor's best interests. But at the same time, we've developed a scheme that guarantees that that same minor will lack the capacity under Illinois law to consent to that very procedure. There was also reference to the EH case and maturity. EH case is a case that discusses the Consent by Minors Act. I would just remind that, again, the Consent by Minors Act does elevate the minor to the status of the adult. And therefore, whatever might be true of standards that are typically used to evaluate the quote-unquote maturity of minors are not the sort of standards that govern in deciding the capacity of an adult. The incapacity finding needed to disqualify a pregnant minor or any other minor covered by the Consent by Minors Act has to be the same kind of incapacity finding that would disable any adult from making a medical decision. There was also reference to the cases that we rely upon from other jurisdictions regarding interpretation of their version of D1, the first Bilotti factor. Again, the point there is not that capacity, this minimal capacity requirement, the ability to understand, does not make its way into that analysis. Indeed, it does. But they're far broader. What those cases show is that courts are interpreting maturity for Bilotti purposes, for what we would call D1 purposes, in a far broader way. It's more than just the bare capacity to make an informed decision. And again, that's what distinguishes it as a matter of Illinois law from the bare capacity that any adult would have to have is different, is not legally identical to maturity as used in the statute. Finally, there was a reference to the Montana statute that was at issue in Lambert, and I would just add again, as we point out in our brief, to our knowledge, and there's been no rebuttal on this, the Montana statute, there's no background provision that allows minors to consent to anything, pregnant minors, in Montana. And therefore, naturally, it makes sense that that statute would provide expressly for not only the waiver of notice, but indeed the capacity to consent. Likewise, with the Ohio statute that was at issue in the Akron case of 1990 that was also mentioned. The court has no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to all counsel in this case. The case will be taken under advisement, and we move.